Chapter 11. PRU. In early 1967, Frank Scotton left his post in Taiwan and returned to Saigon to help set up cords. Upon arriving in country, Scotton found Colonel Nguyen Bay, who was investigating corruption within RD units, in Quinyong being set up for assassination. While the hit team, dispatched by General Lu Lam, the 2 Corps commander, was hunting him down, Scotton told me, I flew him to safety in Pleiku. In the meantime, Ed Lansdale arranged with the RD minister, General Nguyen Duc Thanh, for Bay to assume control of Vung Tau from Tran Nhoc Chau. Chau went on to campaign for a seat in the National Assembly, itself recently instituted under South Vietnam's new constitution. Soon after this changing of the guard, Tom Donohue, then George Carver's deputy at Sava, paid a visit to Vung Tau. Robert Eschbach had replaced Ace Ellis as director of the National Training Center. Jean Savageau had taken over the Revolutionary Development Cadre Training Program, and Tucker Gugelman managed the PRU. On the Vietnamese side, Donohue told me, Bay was in charge, but he wasn't in the same league as Mai, who was in the Saigon office cutting paper dolls. Under the tutelage of Nguyen Bay, according to Jim Ward, the RD teams no longer had a security mission. In order to foster a democratic society, Bay had transformed RD from the Intelligence and Displacement Program Frank Scotton had started 3 years earlier in Quang Nai Province into one that emphasized nation-building, but with little success. Of South Vietnam's 15,000-odd villages, only a few hundred were secure enough to hold elections in 1967, and where elections were held, they were typically a sham. The RD teams had nominated all the elected village chiefs after the chiefs had been recruited by the CIA and trained at Vung Tau. Nevertheless, the village chiefs really didn't know what they were supposed to do or represent, and, as a matter of practicality, their top priority often was accommodating the local VC. And so, with the revolutionary development teams on the defensive, the attack against the VCI fell to Phoenix, or was contracted out. For example, in order to ferret out the VCI in critical Taining province, President Johnson hired, at the cost of $39 million, the services of a Filipino civic action team. Meanwhile, in Saigon, fantastic amounts of money were being spent, $75 million in 1967, in support of RD. But corruption was rife, and much of the money was diverted into people's pockets. For example, while inspecting Quang Nai province in mid-1967, RDCO Chief Renz Hoeksema found 800 ghost employees out of a total of 1,300 cadres on the province RD cadre payroll. Hoeksema set up a fingerprinting system to prevent further abuses, which, considering that each cadre was paid the equivalent of $10 a month, continued unabated. Despite the problems of corruption and accommodation, the RD program continued to have intelligence potential, mainly through its static and mobile census grievance elements. According to Robert Pert, who in late 1967 replaced Renz Hoeksema, the RD program's primary mission was still to put eyes and ears in districts where there were none before. To this end, Pert managed 284 paramilitary officers in the provinces, each of whom fed information on the VCI into DIOCCs and PIOCCs, while passing information gotten from unilateral sources to the CIA station in Saigon through secure agency channels. On the Vietnamese side, information on the VCI was fed to the province chiefs who, according to Jim Ward, may or may not turn this over to Phoenix. In any event, the political war was not going well in late 1967, and with a shift in emphasis to nation-building, Phoenix emerged from the RD matrix as the CIA's main weapon against the VCI. Its 2 major action arms, as stated in MACV Directive 381 and Action Program Tab 9, were the PRU and field police. Of the two, the PRU were by far the most effective and suffered the lowest casualties, according to the 1966 Combined Campaign Plan, which also noted that the type of target attacked by the PRU was strategically most significant. This chapter focuses on the PRU, which more than any other program is associated with Phoenix. But first, a quick review of the field police, which at the behest of Robert Comer was to be redirected against the infrastructure as its main function. Naturally, Colonel William Poppy Greaves did not respond favorably to this redirection of the field police, calling it a misreading of its mission and calling Phoenix a phase that set us back. As an example of the proper use of field police, Greaves, in a briefing for General Abrams, cited Operation Dragnet in Bingding Province, in which three companies of field police at a time, for 2 4-month cycles, worked with the 1st Cavalry Division in cordon and search operations. As another example of the proper use of field police, Greaves cited CT-4 and Operation Fairfax, in which field police search teams operated under the protection of security squads provided by the 199th Light Infantry Brigade. Working in six-man teams, the field police searched hooches for hidden documents and weapons and set up screening centers for suspects, where they checked names against blacklists and faces against photos obtained from the Family Census Program. Field policemen also checked ID, voter registration, and draft cards. Such were the functions Greaves believed were appropriate for a law enforcement organization dedicated to providing police services to the public. He complained to Abrams, "Then Phoenix was upon us. At the direction and insistence of Ambassador Comer, the field police SOP was drastically reoriented and reworded, with new emphasis on the anti-subversive mission, which was the only mission which was spelled out, and which was emphasized as the first priority mission. This mission statement resulted in the tremendous underutilization of the field police. Proper field police missions, other than anti-subversive, were ignored. Police commanders, local officials, and U.S. advisors considered the job done when a field police platoon was given carte blanche to a DIOCC, completely ignoring the fact that Phoenix agencies were not producing enough real targets to keep any of the multiplicity of reaction forces available to them fully occupied on this single mission. Perfectly appropriate and suitable missions assigned to field police units not fully in use by Phoenix were constantly reported by U.S. advisors and observers, including Comer, as misuse of field police. In other words, in the rush to destroy the VCI, a successful police program was derailed. Likewise, with the redirection of the field police against the VCI, much to Greaves's dismay, public safety advisors like Doug McCollum found themselves working more closely than ever with the special branch and its CIA advisors. In accordance with procedures instituted by Robert Comer, McCollum began receiving aid-in-kind funds through the province senior advisor. "I was given $20,000 a month," he recalled, "which I had to spend to develop agent networks in Darlak province." McCollum developed three nets, comprised 90% of Mountain Guards, and presented the intelligence these nets produced at weekly meetings among himself, the CIA's province officer, and the MACV senior intelligence officer. These meetings compared notes on enemy troop movements, VCI suspects, double agents, and double dippers, agents who were working for more than one U.S. agency. The CIA's province officer, according to McCollum, got his intelligence from the PRU and the Trungson Mountain Guard RD program. When VCI members were identified, individual or joint operations were mounted. When called upon to contribute, McCollum dispatched his field police company under former Special Forces Sergeant Babe Ruth Anderson. The PRU advisor, Roger, was a mercenary hired by and reporting only to the province officer. "It was two halves of the apple," McCollum recalled, "collection and operations. We would get blacklists from the province officer with names of people in villages or hamlets. The field police went out with ARVN units or elements of the U.S. 4th Division, usually on cordon and search operations. We'd select a target. The day before we were going to hit it, we'd get picked up in the morning by white Air America choppers. I'd take 25 or 30 field police, and we'd land about 10 miles away and set up a base camp with elements of the 4th Division. We'd get up at 3 a.m., surround the village, and at daybreak send in a squad to check for booby traps. Then we'd go in, search the place, segregate women and children from men, check people against the blacklist, and take them into custody. We'd get money, boots, and medicine, and sometimes NVA. If the VCI were classified A or B, hardcore, they were sent to the pick. At that point, it was out of my hands. We'd take the other prisoners back to Bon Metot in police custody. We did not give them to the military. Coming back to camp, the U.S. 4th Division would use the field police as point men." As McCollum described them, the field police were used, as Greaves intended, as roving patrols outside Bon Metot more often than they were used against the VCI. However, because they did on occasion go after the VCI, by 1967 the field police were being compared with the PRU. In an October 1967 article in Ramparts, David Welch quotes the Hanhua Province Psychological Warfare Officer as saying that the field police work just like the PRU boys. Their main job is to zap the in-betweeners, you know, the people who aren't all the way with the government and aren't all the way with the Viet Cong either. They figure if you zap enough in-betweeners, people will begin to get the idea. Just like the PRU boys? Unlikely. On February 18, 1967, Chalmers Roberts, reporting for the Washington Post on the subject of counterterror, wrote that one form of psychological pressure on the guerrillas which the Americans do not advertise is the PRU. The PRU work on the theory of giving back what the Viet Cong deals out, assassination and butchery. Accordingly, a Viet Cong unit on occasion will find the disemboweled remains of its fellows along a well-trod canal bank path, an effective message to guerrillas and to non-committed Vietnamese. The two can play the same bloody game. Comer may have wished that the field police would operate like the PRU, and in some cases it did. But the PRU had counterterror and intelligence collection missions which the field police never had, even under Phoenix. Moreover, the PRU were not a law enforcement organization. In fact, as CIA assets, they operated outside the law and had no legal powers of arrest. The PRU were the personification of the special forces behind-the-lines mentality, which in a counterinsurgency meant getting the VCI in its own villages. Jim Ward put it this way: to get a guy in enemy territory, you've got to get an armed intelligence collection unit where the guy's got the balls to go into an area to perform the mission. You're not going to get police officers who are walking a beat in town or the special branch guy who deals with agents. Generally, the PRU is the outfit that's best equipped. The problem with the PRU, writes Warren Milberg, was that the idea of going out after one particular individual was generally not very appealing, since even if the individual was captured, the headlines would not be very great in terms of body counts, weapons captured, or some other measure of success. As Milberg observes, careers were at stake and impressive results were expected. In view of these conflicting pressures, the official call for small unit operations against the VCI and the dearth of impressive results the job afforded, by 1967 a new breed of officer was being introduced to the Vietnam War. While conventional warriors continued to search for big battles, highly trained and motivated unconventional warfare officers, with an abiding appreciation for public relations, were called upon to manage the counterinsurgency. One of the new breed was Navy Lieutenant John Wilbur, a tall, husky, sensitive Yale graduate. In April 1967, Wilbur journeyed to Vietnam as deputy commander of SEAL Team 2, a 12-man detachment with no combat veterans in its ranks, which was assigned to a Naval Rivertine Warfare Group and quartered in a Quonset hut at the Mai Tho River Dock Facility in the middle of the Mekong Delta. Frankly, Wilbur, now an attorney in Palm Beach, told me, the Navy didn't know what to do with us. They didn't know how to target us or how to operationally control us. So basically, they said, you guys are to go out and interdict supply lines and conduct harassing ambushes and create destruction upon the enemy however you can. Mostly, we were to be reactive to and protective of the Navy's PBRs, river patrol boats. That was probably our most understandable and direct mission. The PBR squadron leaders would bring us intelligence from the PBR patrols. They would report where they saw enemy troops or if there was an ambush of a PBR. Then we'd go out and get the guys who did it. Knowing what to do and doing it, however, were two vastly different things. Despite their being highly trained and disciplined, Wilbur confessed, that first month we started out with the typical disastrous screw-up operations. In our first operation, we went out at low tide and ended up getting stuck in mud flats in broad daylight for 6 hours before we could be extracted. We didn't have any Vietnamese with us, and we didn't understand very basic things. We didn't know whether it was a VC cadre or a guy trying to pick up a piece of ass late at night. The only thing we had were curfews and free fire zones. And what a curfew was and what a free fire zone was became sort of an administrative political decision. For all we knew, everybody there was terrible. We got lost. We got hurt. People were shooting back at us. And other times we never got to a place where we could find people to shoot at. There was a lot of frustration, Wilbur said, of having no assurance that the information you got was at all reliable and timely. As an example, Wilbur cited the time, "We raided an island across from where the U.S. 9th Infantry Division was based. We surrounded the settlement that morning and came in with our guns blazing. I remember crawling into a hut, which in Vietnam was a sort of shed encompassing a mud pillbox where people would hide from attacks, looking for a VC field hospital. There I was with a hand grenade with a pin pulled, my hand on my automatic, guys running around, adrenaline going crazy, people screaming. And I didn't know who the hell was shooting at who. I can remember that I just wanted to throw the goddamn grenade in the hut and screw whoever was in it. And all of a sudden, discovering there was nothing but women and children in there. It was a very poignant experience." This was during the first two-month period, Wilbur said, shaking his head. Then one day, a SEAL Team 1 enlisted man who was assigned to the CIA came down to me at Taw. His name was Dave, and he was one of two advisors to the PRU, whom we vaguely knew to be independent. Dave presented us with a whole new perspective. He was dressed in blue jeans and a khaki shirt. He had his own Jeep, and he went where he wanted and did what he wanted to do. He had a sense of place. He gave me a fairly broad brief, which attracted the hell out of me. Then he said, "I've got some people, and I'd like to run some operations with you." In exchange, the SEAL team provided the PRU with increased firepower. Explained Wilbur, "We had all the toys, M79s, Kar-15s, Swedish Ks, grease guns, and grenades. Not only that, we had tremendous support capabilities through the Navy Chopper Squadron, the Seawolves, and the PBRs. And we got immediate reaction through the Navy Chain of Command. So it was advisable for the PRU to work with us. The Vietnamese wanted helicopter rides and that reaction requirement. In exchange, they had the skills, the intelligence, and the experience to know where the bad guys were, who to shoot at and who not to shoot at. It had the potential for a very beneficial relationship. One of the attributes of the PRU was that they were required to be from the province in which they operated, so they had relatives and friends in the area," Wilbur explained, "and they had their own intelligence network set up. They'd go back to their hometown for a couple of days, sit around and drink tea and say, 'What's happening?' And a friend would say, 'Tran's a buddy of mine. I'll tell him about the VC District Chief meeting.' Tran would then tell the PRU advisor, and Wilbur said, Dave would come down and say, 'My guy says there's a VC District Chief meeting. We need some helicopter gunship support. We want to be able to air evac. You give us the Seawolves, we'll give you the operation, and together we'll score a victory.'" At first, Dave assigned one of the PRU to Wilbur as a scout, so the SEALs could adjust to working with the Vietnamese. The teenage scout could more or less indicate where the VC were set up, when they might come by, and where we might ambush them, Wilbur told me. He was the kind of person to say, "We aren't going to go on a PBR into this town. We'll take a little water taxi, and we'll hide on the river till night, then go in at 3 a.m. and go there." "He helped us chart a course for the war," Wilbur added respectfully. "He gave me a sense of confidence and made us feel that we weren't spinning our self-destructive wheels. I was very aware of how minimally trained most Americans were. I remember being in the Seawolf helicopters and people shooting at peasants on water buffaloes, or at fishermen in dugouts because they happened to be in free-fire zones, or rocketing huts and burning things down. But with the PRU, I had the ability to control things better than the William Callies did. I was a professional officer in an elite organization that had a lot of pride, and we were not going to mess up. I remember one evening on an LST, right after an operation, sensing there was nothing but anarchy bordering on idiocy in how we were conducting the war," Wilbur sighed. "I remember writing a letter in my mind to Yale University President Kingman Brewster, telling him how important it was for people who had some moral training and education to be on the ground to prevent the negligent cruelties that occurred. I saw myself as that person. I saw an opportunity for SEAL team assets and training to multiply exponentially by working with the PRU. I didn't have any master plan, but I felt, when I am with this kid, I think I know where he's going, and when he puts his hand on my arm and whispers, 'Don't shoot,' I know that I shouldn't shoot. And those were significant things. You felt he was guiding you to do something you ought to do and preventing you from doing what you ought not to do. This guy proved himself to me," Wilbur stated emphatically. "He was able to command in the field. He was at home, and I wanted to be like that. He was a very good influence. Plus which, the Vietnamese are very sweet, affectionate people. You'd go to places and they'd be walking around holding hands with American sergeants. Or they'd come up behind you, put their arms around you, hug you, and offer you some cigarettes. The kid was like that. He was friendly. He reacted. He hung around and became our mascot, which he liked. Wilbur was also intrigued by the CIA mystique. Dave had this freedom and economy. He was working with intelligent people whom I got to know, and so I indicated to him that I'd like to get into the PRU program. By coincidence, this happened just when the agency wanted to expand the PRU and develop its mission, as they envisioned it, a PR unit in every province with a Special Forces advisor doing the daily operational control. Special Forces, including SEALs, Force Recon Marines, Green Berets, and SAS, British Special Air Service. So, lo and behold, just as I became anxious to get into this area, word came down that the Navy was going to suggest an officer to go up to a 2-week briefing in Saigon to develop a SEAL advisor system in this program. This was July 1967. I was sent to Navy headquarters in Saigon and told to go to a huge house with servant quarters around the walls outside. There we were organized by Bill Riddell. This was his baby, Wilbur said. There were no Vietnamese visible, unlike the RD program. The PRU program was American-controlled, which is absolutely essential. It was the breakdown of that control that eventually led to the destruction of the PRU concept. It is also important to recall that before July 1967, PRU teams were organized and directed by CIA advisors at the province level through the province chief's special assistant for pacification. It was only with the formation of ISICS that the PRU became a national program under CIA officer William R. Riddell, a veteran of Greece and Korea who wore a Marine Corps colonel's uniform. He and I were old and close friends, said Evan Parker, a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve, and there again we cooperated with him and helped. Co-located in USAID 2, Riddell and Parker worked as equal partners. His program was also going after the VCI, according to Parker. These were paramilitary people, mostly former Viet Cong. In many instances, the province chief preferred to use them as his action arm against the infrastructure, rather than regular army forces, which were not as responsive. That's the key. The PRU were directly responsive because you were dealing with the convinced. John Wilbur recalled, Bill Riddell was a good-looking guy, Nordic, blue eyes, tanned, a model type of guy. He was a good salesman, too, smooth bureaucratically and very political. He greased palms well. Bill organized it like a tour, Wilbur said of the briefing in Saigon. There were 15 or 20 of us, SEALs, Special Forces, Force Recon Marines, and straight-leg Army infantry types. Maybe 4 or 5 of each. The way it was set up, the Force Recon people were to be advisors in I Corps, by and large the Special Forces in 2 Corps, the Army in 3 Corps, and the SEALs in 4 Corps. Most of us were officers or senior enlisted men. During the first week, we all stayed at the same hotel, and we were indoctrinated in what Civil Operations and Revolutionary Development Support, CORDS, was all about. Census grievance, revolutionary development, etc. We were given a presentation indicating that we were all volunteers. Then we were told what the PRU mission was, to target the political infrastructure of the Viet Cong, to gather and compile accurate information about it, and to react upon that information to try to destroy the political and economic infrastructure of COSVN. A lot of our briefing concerned COSVN's political, economic, and military arms. We were told what the VCI was, how it operated, and why we were targeted against it. It was almost like learning about CORDS. It was exciting and heady, too. Coming from the military envelope, I was awakened into this whole new world. It was, hey, this is a secret, and we're the tough guys. I was pretty impressed with myself. Then we spent 2 days down at the Vung Tau training camp. It was actually a short helicopter ride north, off of the dunes on the South China Sea. The training facility was a corrugated iron compound with classrooms and barracks, a chow hall and lecture rooms, 200 or 300 people. Then there were rifle ranges and the operational course. There were American instructors, but not many, and the chief administrator was an American, one of the colorful names, bald-headed, barrel-chested, tough, marine-ish. It was also at Vung Tau that I met Kinloch Bull. Then we all returned to our tactical areas of responsibility. I went to Kan Tho to talk further with Kinloch Bull. Described by Nelson Brickham as a strange person, devious and sly, Bull was one of the few foreign intelligence officers to serve as a CIA region officer in charge. A confirmed bachelor, Bull worked undercover as the director of a Catholic boarding school, where he would preside at the head of the table like a headmaster. Tall and thin and fastidious, Bull was a gourmet cook and protege of William Colby's. He was also an intellectual, who confided to Wilbur that his ambition was to sit at a typewriter on the southern tip of the Kamau Peninsula and, like Camus, write existential novels. "We lived in Bing Se Moy," recalled Wilbur, "the motor vehicle hub of Canto. Actually, it was about 5 kilometers up the river, halfway between the city and the airport. We were down an alley surrounded by whorehouses and massage parlors where all the enlisted troops would go. There were 5 or 6 of us in the place, and I was by far the junior. The others were all in their second careers. There was Bill Dodds, a retired army colonel with unconventional warfare experience in Korea and Africa. He was the RDCO in charge of the paramilitary program, of which the PRU was a part. Another guy living there was Wayne Johnson, the Fengding province officer. The special branch person, the RDCP, lived with Kinloch. They were all very paternal, very loyal, very fine people. So I started working for Kinloch Bull," Wilbur said, "but the Navy wanted me still to work for them. They wanted to make the PRU program theirs, so they could brag about it. But the CIA told me not to provide the Navy with operational reports, so the Navy tried to have me relieved, at which point Kinloch said, 'Well, we'll kick the Navy out of the Delta program then.' It progressed into a tremendous bureaucratic tug of war. Everybody wanted to have the PRU because they inflated their statistics." In describing how the PRU program was structured, Wilbur recalled, "When I got to Kanto in July, 11 of the 16 provinces had PRU units. By September, they all did. The number of PRU varied from province to province. We had a very large detachment in Kanto, maybe 100. The smallest was 20 in Kensiang. I tried to make sure my advisors were all senior enlisted men," Wilbur continued, "from either SEAL Team 1 or 2. I had about half and half. We wanted them for a long period of time, but the SEAL teams wanted to rotate as many people as possible in the program to keep it theirs. I recommended 1-year billets, but it turned out to be 6 months. The advisors were assigned to Cord's province teams and came under the direct command of the CIA's province officer," Wilbur explained. "They were not under my direct operational control, and much to my horror, I found myself in an administrative position. And the senior enlisted people were very political in terms of how they tried to maximize their independence. They loved wearing civilian clothes and saying they worked for the CIA, having cover names and their own private armies, and no bloody officers or bullshit with barracks. So a lot of my job was maintaining good relations between the PRU advisors and the province officers, many of whom were retired Special Forces sergeant majors with distinguished military careers. Often there were sparks between the PRU advisor and province officer because it was a little too close to their old professions. Province officers with military backgrounds often exerted more control over the PRU teams than young college graduate type officers who had difficulty controlling their hard-bitten PRU advisors, many of whom were veterans of Op Plan 34A and the counter-terror program before it was sanitized. So, where I had the most problems," Wilbur explained, "it was usually when the province officer had more expertise in what the PRU were doing and would run it more hands-on and, in many cases, better than the PRU advisor. And in those instances, I had to relieve the PRU advisor. Also, to be honest, a lot of PRU advisors were being manipulated by their PRU people. You can't have people go out on combat operations 3 times a week indefinitely. It's like having teams in the National Football League play 2 games a week. It takes time to recover, and the PRU had a natural and understandable desire to bag it. So the PRU would figure out excuses to get their advisors to resist the operation. Then the PRU advisor would become the man in the middle. Sometimes he'd say, 'Well, we can't go out, we don't have enough people.' In other cases, the PRU advisors tried to win popularity contests with their cadre," according to Wilbur. "And then the province officer would get mad at the PRU advisor for being less responsive to him than the PRU cadre themselves. Then that would create a problem between me and the PRU advisor, and in many instances between me and the province officer. Bill Riddell had the same problem. He was the national PRU advisor, but he had no authority over the region officers. He would tell me to do things, and I would do exactly what my enlisted men would do. If I didn't want to do it, I'd go to Jim Ward and say, 'Do I have to do this?' And he'd say, 'No, I'm going to tell Bill Riddell to go shove it.' In the same way, my PRU advisors would hide behind their province people so as not to do what I wanted them to do. As for the quality of his PRU advisors, Wilbur said, the original SEALs were tough guys who did a lot of training but hadn't fought in any wars. Then they went over to Vietnam. By that time they had kids and they weren't that aggressive. The senior guys wanted to send the PRU people out on operations and stay by the radio, which was a problem. We had one situation where we got the operational report that they went out and killed two people and captured two weapons, but they didn't kill anyone the second time, and it was the same weapon. My PRU advisor would drop the PRU team off in his Jeep, and he'd pick them up, and he'd transport them back and forth, so he never discovered that they were going out and planting weapons. Other guys really rose to the occasion, Wilbur noted, adding that because the older men played it safe, the people who started dominating the SEAL ranks were the young Tiger enlisted men. They'd go out and waste people. One of those young Tiger enlisted men was Navy SEAL Mike Beeman, who worked on the Phoenix program in the Ben Tre and My Tha areas from mid-1968 through February 1969. Beeman's recollections of the PRU resemble Elton Manzioni's more than John Wilbur's. He described the PRU as made up by and large of guys who were doing jail time for murder, rape, theft, assault in Vietnam. The CIA would bail them out of jail under the condition that they would work in these mercenary units. Beeman spoke of the PRU using ears as evidence to prove they had assassinated a particular VCI, and of PRU stealing weapons from South Vietnamese armories and selling them to the CIA. I can remember ambushing a lot of tax collectors, he added. After they made all the collections, you'd hit them in the morning and rob them of the money and, of course, kill them, and then report that all the money was destroyed in the firefight. They'd carry $1,000 at a time, so we'd have quite a party. From Beeman's perspective, Phoenix was a carefully designed program to disrupt the infrastructure of the Viet Cong village systems, and apparently on some occasions the plan was to come in and assassinate a village chief and make it look like the Viet Cong did it. The idea, he explained, was to break down the entire Viet Cong system in that area, a plan which did not work because the Viet Cong didn't organize in hierarchies. If you organize in a big hierarchy, Beeman explained, and have one king at the top and you wipe out the king, that is going to disrupt the leadership. On the other hand, if you organize in small guerrilla units, you have to wipe out every single leader. Plus, if you organize in small units, you have communication across units and everybody can assume leadership. It is my feeling, he said, that later on we were hitting people that the Viet Cong wanted us to hit because they would feed information through us and other intelligence sources to the CIA and set up a target that maybe wasn't a Viet Cong, but some person they wanted wiped out. It might even have been a South Vietnamese leader. I didn't understand Vietnamese. The guy could have said he was president for all I knew. He wasn't talking with me. I had a knife on him. It was just absolute chaos out there. Here we are, their top unit. It was absolutely insane. From that you can perceive what my job was, Wilbur told me, referring to the dichotomy between the theoretical goals of administrative officers and the operational realities endured by enlisted men trying to achieve those goals. It was quality control, he said. I spent a lot of time traveling between the provinces, doing inspections and field checks on the efficiency of these groups. My objective was to go out on operations with all the units so I could report from first-hand knowledge on what their capabilities and problems were. I was constantly on the road, except when Dodds would make me sit in the office and handle the reports which were sent to me from the PRU advisors in the field. The biggest problem was the thousands of reports. Everybody became desk-bound, just trying to supply the paper that fed Saigon and Washington. They were not only desk-bound, but oblivious as well. Intelligence people operate in a closet a great deal, according to Wilbur. It got so the guy literally didn't know what was happening on the street corner where he was, 15 feet away from him, when he could find the answer by asking someone over coffee. Operationally, our biggest grapple was the demand to go out and capture VC cadre, Wilbur continued. Word would come down from Saigon. We want a province-level cadre, Wilbur said. Well, very rarely did we ever hear of one of those. Then Colby would say, we're out here to get the infrastructure. Who have you got in the infrastructure? Well, we don't have anyone in the infrastructure. We got a village guy and a hamlet chief. So Colby would say, I want some district people, goddammit. Get district people. But operationally, there's nothing more difficult to do than to capture somebody who's got a gun and doesn't want to be captured. It's a nightmare out there. And you don't just say, put up your hands, you're under arrest. First of all, Wilbur explained, The targets, in many cases, were illusionary and elusive. Illusionary in that we never really knew who the VC district chief was. In some cases, there wasn't any district there. And even if there was someone there, to find out where he was going to be tomorrow and get the machinery there before him, that's the elusive part. Operationally, in order to do that, you have to work very comprehensively on a target to the exclusion of all other demands. To get a district chief, you may have to isolate an agent out there and set in motion an operation that may not culminate for 6 months. It was much easier to go out and shoot people, to set up an ambush. So what happened, the American demand for immediate results to justify this new program, ISICS, started to swamp our operational capabilities. Also, at this particular juncture, the province chiefs started seeing the PRU as their only effective combat reaction force, and they ultimately were not guys you could say no to all the time. So the province advisor had to spend a tremendous amount of time trying to keep the province chief from using the PRU as his personal bodyguards, to guard his house or bridges, or to go fight VC battalions. We literally had times where the province chiefs ordered the PRU to go engage a battalion, and therein was the daily tension of trying to keep the PRU on track to respond to the demand for high-level cadre-type targets. The value of pursuing such an illusionary and elusive policy was, of course, debated within the CIA itself, with Jim Ward and Kinloch Bull personifying the CIA's schizophrenia on the subject. Kinloch was a plans-oriented person, Wilbur stated. He saw the problems of the inability to control a PRU-type operation. It was the Battle of the Bulge. Less staff people, more contract people, and less quality among the contract people. More and more programs, more involvement in overt paramilitary activities, paying for revolutionary development and things other than classic intelligence functions. But whereas Bull tried to stem the tide, his replacement, Jim Ward, hastened the inevitable. PRU was Jim Ward's baby, Wilbur remarked. That was his love. PRU in the Delta, said Ward, were the finest fighting force in the country. How does Ward know? I went out with a PRU, he answered, but just to see how they were operating. And Ward expected his province officers to do likewise. We encouraged the province officers to go on enough of these operations to make sure they're properly connected. But the SEAL guy had to go on more, he added. Doc Sells down in Baclio province used to go on three-man operations. He went out at night dressed in black pajamas, his face darkened with root juices. They'd go deep into enemy territory, they'd grab some figure, and they'd bring him back. On the subject of terror, Ward said, the PRU started off as a counter-terror program, but that wasn't too well received in certain areas. That wasn't the basic mission anyway. They were to get at the guys who were ordering the assassinations of school teachers and the village headmen. They were trying to counter terror. Their basic mission was as an armed intelligence collection unit to capture prisoners and bring back documents. RDC Chief Lou Lapham agreed when I spoke with him in 1986, saying that he directed that the PRU capture VCI members and take them to PICS for interrogation. But none of us were so naive, he added, as to think that we could stop every PRU team from carrying out the assassination mission they had as CTs. We lived in the real world. You just cannot control the people fighting the war, as Phoenix attempted to do. Jim Ward wanted ISICS to work, Wilbur said apologetically. ISICS was something that Jim came in and proselytized. Committees were set up. But since ISICS was a broad term that assumed coordination of multi-agencies, I perceived it as something that was going to make the intelligence-gathering capabilities more efficient, and that we in the PRU program were simply going to continue doing what we were doing. The idea of ISICS was to give us better and more timely information on the VCI, and we were going to be the reaction arm of ISICS. The field police were the reaction arm of the plans people. We're on call. ISICS comes in with a hot number, and we go out with the ambulance. ISICS was a name and appeared to create a process, but the process was informally in place anyway. As for the viability of the Phoenix PRU program, Wilbur commented, people didn't recognize the practical difficulties of achieving what its academic objective was to be, which somehow was to be an ambulance squad that went out and anesthetized the district people and brought them in to the DIOCC or PIOCC or the PIC, where they were mentally dissected and all this information would come in. It was a rhetorical approach that just didn't work out there. In any event, Wilbur said, Tet put all that in abatement. Tet happens, and it's, don't give me all this ISICS crap. Go out and get the guys with the guns. Tet propelled the PRU into conventional-type small-unit infantry tactics, which, really, they felt more comfortable with than this sophisticated mission, which was elusive and illusionary. "There's a VC squad in the woods. Let's go get 'em." It was a more tangible and interesting thing to do. It's easier to go on an ambush. This dissolution of the PRU, according to Wilbur, marked the beginning of the end of the program. People began perceiving them as a strike force, a shock troop sort of thing, he said, adding, "With Tet, the PRU got visible. They produced staggering statistics, which became attractive for manipulation and distraction. The objectives started becoming slogans."